listening to another episode of the Business of Aesthetics podcast series brought to you by our gold sponsor, AMP. AMP innovates your aesthetic practice. We also want to thank our silver sponsors, Eilis Works and Pronox. Today we are going to be speaking with one of the finest experts in aesthetics. Our host, Jeffrey Richmond, is an award-winning 20-year veteran of the aesthetic industry whose passion led him to co-found the Business of Aesthetics community. Over to you, Jeff.
Good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of the Business of Aesthetics podcast. We're excited today to have Sarah Schickman with us. Sarah comes to us from Lengia Law. Sarah's a lawyer that has been really, I'll let her tell more about it, but really has specialized in the healthcare arena and even more so in the aesthetic arena in the last decade or so, and has participated in a lot of our associations. You may have seen her speak or an article that she's written, but we invited Sarah. She's been a terrific participant in our Facebook group and our LinkedIn group, and we invited her today to talk about a number of things that I think we as practitioners find confusing, and hoping she can shed some light for us. So Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, Jeff.
I want to, let's take a quick second and just maybe give a brief history of yourself and your law firm. And then I want to jump right in, and I have so many questions I want to ask you.
Sure. So my name is Sarah. I have been a lawyer since 2006. I graduated from Penn Law. I practiced corporate law for a while. I had started a couple of online companies as well, so I know what it's like to be an entrepreneur a little bit. And then I started working as a general counsel of a medical spa and a software company. And through that, learned about this amazing industry, and then started this law firm a few years ago, and now have a couple of associates as well. And I would say most of our practice is medical spa law and aesthetics law and aesthetic technology law. And it's a super exciting space with lots of opportunity that we see growing in a big way. And it's really awesome to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. I want to start out with maybe a simple question, or one that should be asked more, but maybe doesn't get asked enough, which is, When do we use lawyers? You know, when should we use lawyers? And I want to get to mistakes and misunderstandings of law that we have in medical spas. But I think a lot of that may come from not having the proper advice from the get-go, or not having, you know, the someone on your side in terms of getting the right direction. So can you maybe take a few minutes and just share with us, where do you see a medical spa practice using a lawyer, needing a lawyer? And if they don't have one, where, you know, what area should they reach out and say, oh, shoot, I better go get a relationship with someone?
Sure. Great question. I think the first place where a lot of people use us is in the formation stage. So we really believe prevention is way cheaper than correction. That applies to wrinkles, and that applies to law as well. So when people are starting a medical spa, really figuring out the right structure in your state and then the kind of ownership you can have. You know, in some states, medical spas can be owned by non-doctors. In some states, they have to be doctors or nurse practitioners and all that kind of stuff. So the first part is really formation. The second part that we work with is change. So sometimes that's growth. So when a medical spa opens their second location, or sometimes it's HR growth, when people are hiring a key employee, we do the employment contracts, or, you know, an HR problem, like when there needs to be a severance agreement or a non-compete violation, we do that. And then we also do mergers and acquisitions. So we represent medical spas and private equity groups when medical spas try to sell their practice or merge with another practice or get an investor. So those are the three main areas, but it all starts with the formation. That's the important part, because if it's not structured correctly, and we could talk more about that, the consequences of that kind of never go away, because then it's a problem when you sell, it's a problem if you get sued, it's a problem if any regulator comes in. So that's when we get involved.
And you mean in terms of corporate structures? So what type of a corporation I set up and those types of things?
Yeah, I mean, like whether you need a management company, whether it's just going to be a direct physician owned entity, who the partners are in the company. So some states restrict different types of people from having ownership in a medical company. And so people are like, well, I'm a spa or I'm a medical spa. The medical law doesn't apply to me. Or sometimes people have that misunderstanding, but that's not really correct. So it really, figuring out what kind of corporate structure you need to have from the beginning is a really important question.
Yeah, and I would add to that, having also been involved in lots of different types of startups, I mean, if you have partners, if you're looking to have partners in the future, if you're going to pay yourself a salary from the get-go, or you're only going to take a distribution, if you're doing profit share with employees or some key employees, and then you mentioned non-competes, you went those back, all of these things become relevant. And it's making money is a huge part of what we do, of course, on the profit side, but keeping our money is also a big part of what we do.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's really hard getting a partner to sign a partnership agreement or some kind of agreement after the business has started. It's something about it, you know, I'm not sure what it is, but a lot of times people come to us and they already have a business and they already have partners, and then they want to formalize the agreement. But at that point, things are already complex, and one partner has some resentment toward the other about how much they're working and how much they contributed. So much better to have that kind of stuff ironed out in the beginning, even if it's a little bit costly or a little bit uncomfortable, because inevitably these among partners, especially unequal partners. And what I mean is, like, in this business, we see a lot of partnerships where, let's say it's a nurse practitioner, a registered nurse, and a business person, or an esthetician and a nurse practitioner. Some time goes by and one person says, well, I bring in this and you bring in that, and I did this and you did that. And remember when your mother came in and she got 20 syringes of filler. So just better to do in the beginning.
It makes so much sense. And partnerships are difficult. Most partnerships fail because of the partnership. And knowing that as a reality, having things like buy-sell agreements in the beginning really help, I mean, in a lot of times save friendships, even if partnerships end.
Yeah.
So those are great reasons to use you up front. I would also, I mean, for employees, I've been guilty of this in some companies and other companies. I've done it really well right from the get-go. But employees policy and procedures manuals, job descriptions, sometimes I hear like having these things is worse because now you've put it in writing and you're too small of a company. Other times I hear, no, you need to get all of this stuff down, even if you're only a couple of employees. What can you share some light?
Yeah, I think what you said is right. Sometimes having it is worse than not having it at all. And that's when you have it in place, but you don't follow it. So that's worse than not having it. So if you're going to have it and never follow it, then, you know, I would say don't do it. But having it and having it be flexible enough is way better than not having it. So yes, having a very comprehensive job description can be hurtful to the company. But if you have a flexible job description for your employee, for example, it says, you know, and other duties as may be needed, as may be assigned by management or whatever, and you want to add to the person's job description, that's great. Then you always have a job description to point to when doing reviews. And you could say, well, your job description is A, B, C, and D, and you didn't do this, or you did this great. And it also helps the employee too, to know, okay, what is my job and how do I define whether I'm doing my job well? So I think it does help. And the same thing with policies and procedures. Like if God forbid somebody gets sued, one of the first things people will look for is, were the policies and procedures followed, right? And if you had no policies and procedures, and then you have no real defense there, the employee will say, well, they told me to do this like this. And you'll say, oh, but no, that wasn't it. But if you have a signed policies and procedures manual that the employee said that they read and they understand, that says do this like this, and they actually did it completely differently, that protects you in a huge way. But at the same time, like I was saying, like if you have a policies and procedures book that says one thing and the and then you in practice you do something totally different, that's not great. So it's a tricky subject, but yeah, in this industry, having really tight policies and procedures, it also prevents some adverse events, right? If you say, when you do laser and that's, you know, you always do the skin typing test first, sign here that you will do it every single time. And then someone gets burnt on a laser treatment and you realize there wasn't, you know, they didn't do the Fitzpatrick test or whatever you wanted them to do. That's something that you could point to always that'll help you.
If I have a staff of four or five, I think that's where people really struggle with job descriptions, especially, but on the employee policy and procedures manual, even with a small staff, is that something I want to get going from the get-go?
Definitely. I think even if you have one employee, right, or one contractor, and you're having them do medical procedures, do you want them to do them however they feel like? I mean, that's a tremendous amount of variety and liability. I think it would be much better to have a tight policies and procedures, even if you have even one employee that says you have to do this, like the precise things the way you want them to be done. Like, for example, you know, never put filler in somebody's forehead. You're not allowed to, right? Or never put filler in somebody's nose if that's going to be your policy. You would put that there, they would sign it, and then you would make sure that they're not doing it. So I think it is important, even if you just have one person.
That I think a lot of times those are verbal conversations between, say, a doctor and a physician extender. What you're saying, though, is it needs to be written down and documented. So a lot of physicians aren't taking the time during the day. Are these kind of boilerplates that can I go purchase a employee procedures manual and then tweak it with somebody, or do I have to sit and think through all these things myself and write all this stuff out myself?
So we have templates that people purchase. So that's one option. But again, you want to make sure that what's happening in your practice is actually matching the template. So let's say you buy our template and it has, you know, 50 pages and covers many, many procedures. But actually in your practice, you do allow people to do, you know, noses. Or, you know, in your practice, when someone comes in for, you know, Botox, you allow them to put 100 units in somebody's forehead. Let's just say that that's your practice. But in this manual, it will say that, you know, you're not allowed to do that. That gives you liability. So you would just, I think you could buy a template, but you have to read it and make sure what you're doing actually matches it. And if it doesn't, get it customized or customize it yourself.
What are some of the other common mistakes you see made by medical spas and things? I know you work throughout the United States, so you're seeing things, and I'm sure at this point, because you're so specialized, you're seeing trends. You know, what are some of the common things that you're seeing around the country?
I think a lot of it has to do with employment, like not having good employment agreements with people. A lot of it has to do with not enforcing certain things, and then having this history of non-enforcement, and then someone takes you to court and says, well, they never enforced it. That's like the HR stuff is really tough, I think, in this industry. That's what I see a lot. HR kind of mistakes. I mean, and I've made HR mistakes. So they're difficult because these are people and you want to be nice to them and they're like your family, you know, so I get that. And the other mistakes are like not really having the right providers doing the right procedures. You know, sometimes like delegating things to people who shouldn't be doing it. And there are, you know, sometimes workarounds around it, but sometimes like the law is really clear. And if it's not followed and you get a complaint, you know, there's not a lot of defense. If the law clearly says, you know, in your state, microneedling needs to be done only by a nurse practitioner, even though everybody on your block may be doing, aestheticians may be doing it or whatever, that's not a defense. So, you know, but there could have been like a different way of doing it. So in some states where that's applicable, somebody with a tattoo license, for example, could also do microneedling. So you would ask a lawyer and say, okay, in my state, you know, who can do microneedling? And they would give you some different workarounds for you. So I think a lot of the mistakes have to do with either contract with people or, you know, people doing things outside of their scope. And then I think the third one, which is a big one, is like the not understanding FDA regulations and who they apply to, and the trying to follow FDA regulations that are not applicable on the physician level or the mid-level provider level. And we could talk more about that. Like, so for what I mean by that is, let's say there's off-label use and on-label use of devices, right? Like one device, it's, you know, it works for fat reduction and that's its on-label use, but its off-label use is also, you know, muscle building, skin laxity, some other things. The pharmaceutical company, pursuant to their FDA approval and the regulations, they can't market on off-label uses. But you, as a practice, don't have that same restriction. So you could market that to the off-label use. But people, some people don't do that. Some people are afraid of that. And we deal with that issue a lot for people.
I want to stay on that subject, but I want to jump back for one quick second on the core expertise in terms of using device. I see some of those are hard ones, like CO2 laser. I know a lot of states do have laws regarding CO2 laser, but I also see in some states, RNs are allowed to use CO2 lasers, say in a plastic surgery dermatologist's office or something under their supervision. They're able to do the procedure and use the laser. And I know many nurses that are quite effective at doing it, but the nurse board says that they can't do it. The board of nursing nationally says that they can't do it. So they have a conflict between being delegated something legal in their state from a physician and doing something that their board doesn't allow them to do. Have you run into that one?
We have. And in that case, we would ask the local nursing board what their opinion on it is. And a lot of times, you know, if the nursing board says you can do it, the local nursing board, which has the, you know, governing authority on this, they would say you can do it or you can't do it. And if they say you can't do it, then we would ask sometimes the medical board and say, okay, well, if they're working under the supervision of a physician, direct supervision, can they do it? Even if, you know, their nursing board, said they can't do it. And so we, you know, we've definitely run into that issue. And especially with CO2 lasers, the thing is that with some of those lasers, once somebody, you know, if is burned or has some adverse event, sometimes those events could be, you know, permanent or nearly permanent. So there's a lot of liability. So with CO2 lasers specifically, we advise people to be very cautious because in terms of lawsuits, and we don't represent people who are suing medical spas. So we only do the kind of the good side of the law, as we call it, but we get those kind of potential clients all the time. And most of the claims are about lasers and about skin resurfacing lasers. So I would say if one procedure you don't want to mess with and be on the gray area on, CO2 lasers is one of them.
You know, I worked for a number of years with the underwriting team at the doctor's company, which is the largest insurer of plastics now. And at a company that became the doctor's company, I should say. Most of the complications, most of the lawsuits we saw were also with laser resurfacing and mostly with CO2. So I do think we need to be careful with those modalities. One of the suggestions I would just add is that, you know, check in with your liabilities company, because if it's legal, if the medical board allows it, so the doctor feels comfortable and it's legal in the state, and now it's covered under my MedMal policy or the underwrite, you know, I have an email back that says, yes, your nurse can do this, then I feel like I have something defensible.
Yeah, not completely, you know, not 100%, but it's better than not having anything at all, for sure.
Do you review patient consent forms and things like that as well? Do those vary a lot state by state?
They don't vary a lot state by state, only to the with the respect of who can do different procedures state by state. But yeah, we have templates for them, or we review other people's, if somebody already has consent and they want us to look at them, we do that. We also review pre and post treatment questionnaires or instructions. We also review a health screening questionnaire. A lot of people do, the initial exam by, let's say, a nurse practitioner, and then an RN does the actual treatment. So we put together documents like that, what you need to, to make that happen. So yeah, but with consent, there's not too much variability state by state.
So and those forms in terms of flow, you mean, because like I know here in Washington or Oregon, in both cases, I think the a physician really, to the letter of the law, needs to sign off on a treatment plan. And then the plan can be delegated or administered by someone else, but it needs to be in practice, it's usually not come up with by the physician. It's usually signed off with by the physician, and the esthetician comes up with it. But I think the letter of the law is really that the doctor is supposed to come up with the plan. Do you see that in a lot of cases?
We do. And, the doctor has to come up with the plan, and the plan has to be specific. It can't be a standing order, right? It can't be the doctor says, okay, for every client that we see, we prescribe 50 units of Botox, and that's fine. Esthetician can sign off on that. So yeah, it has to be, usually it has to be done by a prescriber, and in different states describe that differently. But let's say that's a doctor, an NP or a PA. And so, and it has to be, it cannot just say Botox, but I recommend, or discuss Botox and filler. It can't be like that. It has to be like very specific, like 50 units of Botox to the upper face and choice of Juvederm Ultra or whatever to for the lips, 1 ml. So it should be a patient specific order, and has to be a, before the procedure is done, not after. And there has been some enforcement around this area, in some states more than others. But for example, we've been involved with it in Ohio, in New York, in Florida. So there's, it's definitely an area where you want to be careful. Right now, because of COVID stuff, I shouldn't say COVID stuff, because of the pandemic, they allow a lot of exceptions to this, but you can do it by telemedicine in many states. Some states are allowing you to do it after the fact. Some states are allowing you to have out-of-state licensed people do it. But theoretically, at least, it will revert back to the stricter standard. But right now, it's a little bit less heavily looked at and heavily regulated to give more flexibility to out-of-state or remote providers.
That's really helpful. I want to get back on the subject that you brought up before a little bit with FDA, because I, in my career and in our practice, I just talking to people, I think there's a lot of confusion about the FDA and what they regulate and how they regulate, I guess. So let me give you a real example. Say like an RF device, may get an FDA approval, I guess.
Yeah.
For general dermatologic use or deep tissue heating.
Mm-hmm.
Deep tissue heating, we all translate to skin tightening in practice, but the FDA doesn't call it skin tightening. It wasn't approved for skin tightening. It was approved for deep dermal heating or tissue heating. So some sales reps, even a competing sales rep, may come and say, well, you can't market that device for skin tightening. That device is only used for deep tissue heating. And that's why they don't have any, approval on it and blah, blah, blah. And what are the rules around that? How do I know what I can do? And then I want to talk about like what's legal, but I also want to talk about what's ethical in terms of, how do I know to draw the line from the promotion standpoint? And then the third piece I want to bring up is at some point, our individual boards may also have a say so in this. So yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Sure. So a lot of times the FDA on-label, off-label regulations, they're really for the manufacturers and manufacturer marketing and pharmaceutical company marketing. So let's say this RF device is, you know, approved for skin heating, but you through your use are seeing that it also, you know, does muscle building or reduces fat. You as a someone marketing to consumers on the internet or whatever, and you not being a device manufacturer, you just being a medical practice in the US, you could still market the off-label use. In the abundance of caution, if you wanted to, on your landing page, you could write somewhere, you know, in a disclaimer section that this use is off-label and not FDA approved. Because if you make any misleading, you can get in trouble for making misleading claims in your ads. So if you say this is an FDA approved machine, it reduces fat and builds muscle, but technically its FDA approval is for something else. The way you phrase that is kind of vague, right? So technically you would still be doing something misleading and that you can get in trouble. But if you said, this great machine reduces fine lines, gets rid of, you know, reduces fat. Oh, and another thing is you claim permanent results. So like if you say this machine permanently gets rid of fat forever, a customer can say, I was misled by this advertising because actually, you know, it's not permanent, or, you know, I don't get rid of the fat forever, or it's not 100%. So you could still make claims like this device is great for X, Y, and Z. And then on the bottom right, this device is FDA approved for, you know, whatever it's actually FDA approved for. And then, yeah, through your practice, you can decide, you know, if this device also maybe improves your skin texture, you would add that to your advertising. There's no problem with that. We have seen some more conservative boards, like the local boards, not being super happy with that kind of advertising, but most of the time that's usually been able to be resolved very amicably by talking to the board and just saying, look, like we are following safety measures and we care about our patients, and look, our ads are not making false claims, and it's not really like we're going to take you to court over it. It's more like having to have a few uncomfortable situations and conversations, which could be overcome.
I mean, the days of getting poo-pooed by all the physicians in town for putting your name in the yellow pages or doing an ad in the paper are so far gone.
I think so.
Yeah,
I think so. But I think some people, we have clients, and I'm sure you have clients who still, especially some of our plastic surgery clients, who say, oh, advertising, like only bad plastic surgeons have to advertise. And then I'm like, well, yes, maybe yes, maybe no, but that person, you know, just sold their practice for, you know, $100 million or whatever. So, you know, it's really what you want to do. If somebody really wants to have a boutique practice and doesn't want, very big growth or doesn't want to be acquired by private equity, that's one strategy and that's totally fine. Like, I respect that. But they're competing against people who are like full force advertising business people who, you know, want to cash out at 100 million and don't want to work forever, don't want to retire at 80, or don't want to keep doing, you know, plastic surgery at, you know, at that age. And so it's really, I think, client specific. Nothing wrong with either approach. But I mean, we're seeing really big growth and really big multiples in the industry in terms of people getting bought by private equity. And if you want to compete at that level, and not everybody does, you absolutely have to advertise aggressively, not making false claims, but very like your name has to be known. It has to be on the internet. That's the truth.
You need cash flow and you need high revenue. And you know, that comes from volume. I agree. And also, even if you are an established practice, patients are still looking, even if they're loyal to you, they're still researching on the internet. If your name is popping up, it further validates the good choice they've already made. So it's not always getting a new client. Sometimes it's keeping a client or validating to the client that you are a leader in the market. So when they make the referral to their mother, they feel good about it. The way that information is shared and trusted is so different now than it used to be, that the, you know, a word alone from my, you know, my mother maybe used to be enough. Now, even my mother's word, I'm still going to go Google it a little bit. And then if mom was right, I'll see right away that mom was right.
Yeah, definitely. I think more than 70% of, you know, decisions that have to do with beauty are influenced by something or other online. I think that I read a study that said something like that. So yeah, you have to have an online presence, and you have to have, you know, people in the practice, like looking at that and managing that, and a business person as part of it. That's the new reality that we're in. It's like, you know, you can't really escape it.
Do you guys help with practice valuations and those types of things as well? If I'm a physician that's looking at maybe selling out of my practice or getting out of it, is that something you would help?
Yeah, so we either do it in-house, or we work with a forensic accountant that we partner with to do it. So yes, we do it both ways. So depending on the practice size and what the practice is looking to do, we definitely do that. We help practices prepare like a package for investors or private equity, or just a, you know, a presentation about their practice. So we've done those types of things as well.
Well, terrific. Sarah, you've been really so helpful to our community. You've shared tons of good information. I feel better about being able to market for those things that I think the devices in my practice can do without worrying about the FDA handcuffing me. I think about our employee policy and procedures manual and job descriptions and all these things that that are important to running my practice and important to putting systems in place that are going to keep me out of trouble. And the fact that you culminated a lot of this stuff already is terrific. So it sounds like you have some boilerplate things that are available, but more so, I know are happy to communicate with anyone. If you have, you know, questions for Sarah, like I said, she is available in our Facebook group and our LinkedIn group. You can email businessofaesthetics.org if there are other questions, and we can maybe post some questions and tag Sarah and get her responses from that. But we really appreciate you being a part of the Business of Aesthetics community today. For those practices that may want to get in touch with you directly, what's the best way to do that?
The best way is through my firm's website, which we'll put a link, I think, in this video, or if not, it's just lengealaw.com, LengeaLaw.com. But I'm always in the Facebook group and the LinkedIn group. So just you guys can reach out to me through there or to the Business of Aesthetics. I love, you know, hearing from you guys. And I love all the questions and all the discussions that happen in the groups. I think it's awesome that there's so much information sharing.
Thank you. Yeah, me too. It's really been terrific lately. And what I've loved lately is how much when a group member poses a question, how many people take the time to really respond to that and to give their insight. And there's not always a right and wrong in a lot of these cases, but maybe some of that is specific to your state, which is why I do think you need to have this legal help or these, just like I mentioned with the patient getting validation, it as a physician practice, it's equally as good to have that validation that you're doing things the right way and have confidence moving forward, have confidence the way that you deal with your staff, knowing that you're on the up to the up. It helps you walk around with your head high and your shoulders back, and you make better decisions from that posture.
Yeah, and you sleep better at night.
Absolutely. And we're all looking for that. Sarah, thank you so much. Coming to us from Lengealaw, Business of Aesthetics, if you love this, please share this. We'll put some post notes together on this. If you want to reach out to Sarah Schickman, she gave you some ways to do that. Thank you all. Have a terrific rest of your day and a terrific weekend.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Business of Aesthetics podcast series, brought to you by our gold sponsor, Aesthetic Management Partners. AMP innovates your aesthetic practice. And silver sponsors, Eilis Works and Pronox. Would you like to join our growing group of aesthetic industry experts and get featured on the Business of Aesthetics podcast? Or do you know someone who would love to share their strategies for growth in the aesthetic business, providing quality patient care or their clinical expertise? Head on over to businessofaesthetics.org/speakers and apply to be featured as a guest on the show. Remember to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen. If you would like to engage with today's or any of our past speakers, join our Facebook group or LinkedIn group by searching for Business of Aesthetics. Thank you and have a great day.